namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
We're reading in Srimad Bhagavatam, fourth chapter. Fourth canto, chapter 2. Pajapati Daksha curses Lord Shiva. This morning, text number 30, which is actually cursed by Bhrigu, a counter-curse by Bhrigu Muni on the followers of Lord Shiva. Brahma
cha
brahmanamschaiva
yad
yuyam parinindatha setum vidaranam pumsam ataha pashandam ashitaha brahma cha brahmanam chaiva yadyuyam parinindatta setum vidharanam bhumsam patapashandam ashitaha. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The translation. Bhrigu Muni continued, since you blaspheme the Vedas and the Brahmanas, who are followers of the Vedic principles, it is understood that you have already taken shelter of the doctrine of atheism. Now Prabhupada's purport. Bhrigu Muni, in cursing Nandishwara, said that not only would they be degraded as atheists because of this curse, but they had already fallen to the standard of atheism because they had blasphemed the Vedas, which are the source of human civilization. Human civilization is based on the qualitative divisions of social order, namely the intelligent class, the martial class, the productive class, and the laborer class. The Vedas provide the right direction for advancing in spiritual cultivation and economic development and regulating the principles of sense gratification so that, ultimately, one may be liberated from material contamination. One may be liberated from material contamination to his real state of spiritual identification. Aham Brahmasmi. As long as one is in the contamination of material existence, one changes bodies from the aquatics up to the position of Brahma. But in the human form of life, is the highest perfectional life in the material world. The Vedas give directions by which to elevate oneself in the next life. The Vedas are the mother for such instructions, and the Brahmanas, or persons who are in knowledge of the Vedas, are the father. Thus, if one blasphemes the Vedas and Brahmanas, naturally, one goes down to the status of atheism. The exact word used in Sanskrit is nastika, which refers to one who does not believe in the Vedas but manufactures some concocted system of religion. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has said that the followers of the Buddhist system of religion are nastikas. In order to establish his doctrine of non-violence, Lord Buddha flatly refused to believe in the Vedas. and thus later on Shankaracharya, stopped the system of religion in India and forced it to go outside India. Here it is stated, Brahma cha Brahmanan. Brahma means the Vedas. Aham Brahmasmi means I am in full knowledge. The Vedic assertion is that one should think that he is Brahman, for actually he is Brahman. If Brahma, or the Vedic spiritual science, is condemned, and the masters of the spiritual science, the Brahmanas, are condemned, then where does human civilization stand? Bhrigu Muni said, it is not due to my cursing that you shall become atheists. You are already situated in the principle of atheism, therefore you are condemned. Brahmacha brahmanam chaiva yadyuyam parinindata setum vidaranam humsam ata parshandam ashita. Bhrigu Muni continued, since you blaspheme the Vedas and the Brahmanas, who are followers of the Vedic principles, it is understood that you have already taken shelter of the doctrine of atheism. Shrutayo vibina, the shrutis, the spiritual texts, they exist in different divisions. And what we have here is a misunderstanding between the practitioners of the different divisions. Daksha, a brahmana, is expert. His name, you know, means expert. Is expert in the Karmakanda division of the Vedas. That's his expertise. But there are other divisions beyond the Karmakanda. Is the Gyanakanda division of the Vedas. This is followed by Lord Shiva and his adherents. So both are actually fulfilling important activities in Vedic culture, but because they are divided in a different way, they have their specializations. Now they've come to misunderstand each other. And so this happens. As always, Vedic culture means to take all different kinds of people and put them together in one harmonious, cooperative unit. But sometimes it's tough to do. And in many instances, this is one of them, of where these Vedic different divisions have led to troubles and misunderstandings. As a result, these curses actually, as Prabhupada points out, they actually come true. The followers of Lord Shiva do end up being like hippies, as Prabhupada puts it. And they the Karmakanda Brahmanas, or the smart Brahmanas, they also become degraded as a result of this counter-cursing. A misunderstanding between Brahmanas and Kshatriyas, where Sringi cursed Maharaj Parikshit. You get another case of people having different duties having these divisions, which are in a way superficial, become all important in people's eyes and lead to this. So here it is a fact that Nandishwara had said bad things about the Vedas. The followers of the Vedas, Vedavada, and about the he mentions, in fact, in the same language, you know, the flowery words of the Vedas. And so he was criticizing those people who were stuck on the Karmakanda platform. Prabhupada mentions them in this purport that the Vedas provide the right direction for advancing in spiritual cultivation and economic development and regulating the principles of sense gratification. This is all, this part of the Vedas is called karma kanda. Karma means fruitive activity, but regulated fruitive activity. There, it's understood that in human civilization, there are always going to be people who are interested in sense gratification. But that sense gratification is regulated and ordered and channeled in such a way so that gradually people can come to higher principles. Of one becomes a transcendentalist. And the Vedas also teach different paths for transcendentalists, the karma yogis, the astanga yogis, the jnana yogis, the bhakti yogis. All of these are transcendentalists. Transcendentalist means people who have understood the conclusion, understood that, come to the conclusion that there is no possibility of becoming happy in this material world. And of course, Krishna is teaching this in the Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita is definitely meant for transcendentalists, those who are at least understand, come to the jnana kanda section of the Vedas, or the nivritti marga. Pravritti marga means the path of trying to engage in regulated sense enjoyment. And then the other side is nivritti marga. Daksha and his folks, they're pravritti marga people. And Lord Shiva and his people, they're nivritti marga people. These two sides are there. Krishna also criticizes the Vedas. Well, he used the flowery words of the Vedas. He doesn't exactly criticize the Vedas. But especially those whose minds have been seduced by the wonderful language of the Vedas, which describes so beautifully the heavenly planets, all the wonderful things that are there. The rivers of nectar, the Somarasa, the Apsaras, the Gandharvas, and all these great things. And then they become attached to this, and they say, there's nothing more than this. They think that's all there is to the Vedas. That's all there is to the Vedas. They take this Karmakanda section to be all in all. So that's what's meant by them. They developed a philosophy called Karma Mimamsa. That school of Vedic thought became this Karma Mimamsa, in which karma also means. Well, it means activities that are prescribed in the Vedas, which also means the activities of sacrifice. Especially the brahmanas were expert at sacrifice. And if you perform a sacrifice exactly right, precisely observing all the different rules and regulations, chanting your mantras just precisely, correctly, like a it's like technology, you know, everything has to be perfect. You do some big piece of work in chemistry, and you've got one dirty test tube, little dirt in the test tube, everything is over. You perform some elaborate experiment in physics and you made one little mistake in your mathematics, the whole thing doesn't work. And half the time in science, people are sitting out, tearing out their hair out, going back, trying to figure out what little mistake did we make. Supposed to work, but it doesn't. Where's the mistake? Because everything has to be technically perfect. And when you manufacture, computer chips, you've seen these people, you know, they look like spacemen, they're in these dust-free rooms, and one little piece of dust gets in, the whole thing is useless. Everything has to be perfect. A Vedic sacrifice is like that. It's really a culture of technology. Now people don't know that technology, and they think of it as magic or something like that, because the people who knew it qualified are no longer available. But by sacrifice, one could sit down. And when a sacrifice was arranged, really you sort of reenacted the creation of the universe as part of the sacrifice. And whatever you wanted, there was a person they called the Yajamana, the patron of the sacrifice, the one to whom the benefits of the sacrifice go. That's the Yajamana, basically the person who pays for it. So the king is the Yajamana's. He doesn't have a son. He needs a son. There's a battle coming up. He wants victory. So people are performing these sacrifices for that or for going to the heavenly planets. And the Brahmins, if they do everything right, the result is there. So in the Karma Mimamsa school, they want to say that this is karma is everything. And in that philosophy, the Karma Mimamsa philosophy, God or the gods are diminished. What's really potent is sacrifice. And it's true that in sacrifice we say the names of the various deities. There's mantras with Indra, Chandra, Surya, they're all mentioned. But actually they have to do what the karma requires of them. It's not that we're getting their mercy; they also have to follow. And so it's just like it developed in that way. It also became almost atheistic. Just like in modern science, people get proud of their technology and their power over nature, and they say, well, God, he's just off in the back. There may be a God, but he is off in the background. He doesn't interfere, or he doesn't exist. It's a similar idea that developed with this Karmakanda division of the Vedas being taken as all in all, losing its relevance to the whole. But of course Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita discusses sacrifice quite a bit, and his showing how that if you really understand the meaning of sacrifice and know what sacrifice is about, you'll come to the understanding of Brahman, the all-pervading transcendence is situated in acts of sacrifice. And then finally in the fourth chapter, Brahmarpanam, Brahmahavir, Brahmagnam, Brahmanahutau, he tells what the real realization of sacrifice is actually the realization of transcendence, nothing to do with fruitive activity at all. And so Krishna condemns those who are actually stuck in this Karmakanda section of the Vedas. In other words, the Vedas actually teach a progressive step by step by step by step. And the Karmakanda section of the Vedas, it's a good thing, because without regulated sense gratification, people would have unregulated sense gratification and they would go to hell. They would sink down to animal species of life. So regulated sense gratification is a very good thing. That's why it's there, because it keeps people from being animals. But to encourage them to perform the regulations, it says, yes, and in Indra Loka, there are these, you think there are beautiful women here, where do you go there? You see these apsaras. You think you have good dope here? Where do you go there? We have this somaras. Not only does it get you intoxicated, but it frees you from sinful reactions. Doesn't get, and so on. They paint this very nice picture. You read about it, that's where you want to go. And it's all this enjoyment, and it's extremely pious at the same time. So it paints this picture, and then the people are attracted. Well, you know, that's really good, so I'm going to be very strict and follow all the junctions in the Vedas. In fact, the Vedas is very clear, but every religion has got this section one way or another. It's just not so clear and explicit. Most times we have learned Christianity, follow the Ten Commandments now. You can enjoy yourself, but just do so according to these Ten Commandments. And if you're not quite as having as much fun as everybody else, that's okay. When you die, you'll go to heaven. But those people who break the Ten Commandments, they'll fry in hell. And it's basically, they're holding up before you either, you know, the carrot and the stick, as they say, you know, the reward and the punishment. This is not a very elevated state of consciousness, but it keeps a lot of people in line. So it's good. But suppose one, at least in Vedic culture, of course, that's just the one level. One is supposed to ultimately understand that even the carrot is not good. The stick is definitely bad, but the carrot is another kind of stick. That anyone who wants to enjoy, has the idea of enjoyment, is condemned to repeated birth and death. You come up to Indraloka, and then you go back down again. Prabhupada was walking in New York City, and a whole bunch of devotees were around him, and he stopped, and he pointed with his stick, and there, like in a crack in the sidewalk, was this weed, this ugly old plant going up. Prabhupada said, "What is that?" He said, "Well, Prabhupada, it's a weed." He says, "No, what is it?" And then people are trying to think, is it a daffodil? Is it a, they're trying to think what's the name of this weed, and some people trying to think what is the Latin name of the weed, because everybody was saying different things, and Prabhupada said no. Then Prabhupada said, it's a demigod who's fallen down in the rain from the heavenly planets and is taken up. This is stated in the Chandogya Upanishad. When you come off of the heavenly planets, you come down in the rain. And Prabhupada somewhere talks about how the mantras for the sacrifice really tell you, you go up and then you come back down in the rain into grains, and the grains are eaten by animals, and it goes into milk, and it goes into the semen, and then you take birth again, and that's the cycle up and down like that. So one is supposed to become to that understanding that of a higher platform. When you want somebody to come from the regulated sense gratification to the platform of renunciation, then regulated sense gratification becomes bad. You see, here's something that is good. We praise, we glorify regulated sense gratification because it's certainly better than unregulated sense gratification. So when it's compared to unregulated sense gratification, it's good. But then if you don't make further progress, this regulated sense gratification becomes attachment, and it's bad. Well, this is what happens in the Vedas. This is why people sometimes get so confused. Is it good or is it bad? Well, it depends. Yes, it's good, but then good is the enemy of the best, isn't it? Because you're supposed to be making progress in this way. So here we have, as I said, the two followers of these different divisions of the Vedas. Now, bad feelings have erupted. I mean, we have to say that Daksha started it because he wanted his daughter to marry somebody nice, somebody with money, somebody who didn't, you know, live in a crematorium. And what father would want his daughter to marry? Marry somebody like that. But you notice that Lord Shiva is cool. He doesn't participate in these. But his followers, they're a little different. So anyway, so the brahmanas are the people that know this Vedic culture. They know the Vedas. Prabhupada often quotes a text, Janmana Jayate, in the beginning. Everyone is by nature, by natural reproduction, a Shudra. But by following the samskaras, one becomes Dvija. Dvija means twice born. Here Prabhupada mentions this twice born. The Brahmana is the father, and Veda Mata, the Vedas are the mother. So one becomes twice born by samskaras. The brahmanas perform these purificatory activities, which includes upanaya, taking of the sacred thread. Dvija here in his broadest, dvija actually denotes, sometimes it's used just to denote brahmanas, but actually brahmanas, kshatriyas, and vaishyas are dvijas. All those three, they undergo the reformatory processes, and they're all three considered dvija. They take the second birth. Birds are also dvija, by the way, because they also have two births, right? One, the egg comes out of the mother bird, and then the egg hatches as one, two births. Now, the birds are also called dvija. So, but a human being who takes second birth, first is the biological birth, and then the second, the spiritual master and the Vedas as the father and mother, that's the second birth. And then Vedapata, then by study of the Vedas, one becomes a Vipra. So Vipra means a Brahmana who's expert in the Vedas. This is mentioned, they do things like horoscopes, astrology, medical, Ayurvedic medicine. They teach Dana Veda, they teach war. The mundane things, astrology and medicine and warfare, political science. But the Vedas contains all those things in a way, such a way that they can be done and you can take care of the ordinary activities of life and still make advancement. So those brahmanas are the teachers of all those divisions of the Vedas. Dakshas like that, Vipra. But then the text says, but a brahmana, in the true sense of the term, of one is one who knows Brahman. One who knows Brahman. So the Vipras and their brahmanas, again you could see this is a misunderstanding here between these two groups. But Prabhupada is upholding the fact that, in fact, the Vedas and the Brahmanas are very important in the whole scheme of things. He says if one blasphemes the Vedas and the Brahmanas, naturally one goes down to the status of atheism. The exact word used in Sanskrit is nastika, which refers to one who does not believe in the Vedas but manufactures some concocted system of religion. This is the precise meaning of the term. When the qualities characteristics of a brahmana, jnana vijnana, astikyam, and the opposite is nastik, nastika, astika and nastika. You know the Sanskrit word asti, it means it is. So this astikyam means, or astika, means one who accepts the authority of the Vedas. He says, it is, the Vedas are real, they're true, I follow them. And one who denies the authority of the Vedas, nastika. So that's why the Sad Darshan, the people say they're orthodox. means about the six darshans, the karma mamamsa, the, I wonder if I can name all six off the top, karma mamamsa, which we've already mentioned, and the purva mamamsa or Vedanta, that's one. Sankhya, the Sankhya philosophy, philosophy of Kannada. Yeah, what do they call it? One's called Nyaya, one's called Vaisheshika, theory of atoms, Pantanjali's Yoga Sutra. I don't know if I named all six, but these are the six darshans. Now they differ quite a bit among themselves. Even we see that the karma kanda minimizes God. You know where you read karma kanda philosophy is, you read it where Krishna talks it, preaches it to his father to get him to stop doing the Indra Yajna, right? Why do we have to pay attention to Indra? Things happen because, you know, so they differ so widely, but they all accept the authority of the Vedas. They all accept the authority of Vedas. But Buddha rejected Vedic authority. Even though he's incarnation of Krishna, he rejected the authority of the Vedas. Prabhupada says, flatly refused to believe in the Vedas. This is the incidence where people who are following the Vedas became, and the karma kanda, the karma got more and more elaborate, and the traditional Vedic sacrifices involves the sacrifice of animals, but they turned into just slaughterhouses. People became attached to meat eating, and then there was huge animal sacrifices just for the purposes of meat eating. This is the problem with regulated sense gratification, that in time people forget the regulations. You always find their priests, just like lawyers, who can find their way through anything. There's a restriction and they say, well, we have to understand this word means this, or we have to understand the context, and you can do that if you're clever. I could put an ad in an ISKCON paper, and I could say, somebody could say to me, I could say, write in and tell me what you want to do, and I'll find you the quotes from Prabhupada so you could do it. I have a very successful business in this way. If you're clever but not honest, you can create untold mischief quoting Shastra. As I said, the devil can quote scripture, you know. There's many of these different divisions like this. Buddha saw that what was happening, that this division, this karma kanda, and in the name of Vedic sacrifice, so much meat eating was going on, and also corrupt brahmanas who were allowing this to happen, who had found the loopholes, just like the lawyers, you know, they find the loopholes that we call them in America, you know, the expert finding a little gap in the law where the legislators left something out, and through there they shove huge things nobody anticipated through. So he then denied the authority of the Vedas. I don't accept the Vedas. And also, as a result of Buddha's work, the Brahmanas became completely disenfranchised. Buddha himself, you know, came from the Kshatriya background. He was Prince Siddhartha. And so the Brahmanas became disestablished, and the Vedas were rejected, and this philosophy, because of Emperor Ashok, it took hold in India, and the result was that this kind of sacrifice stopped. Then later on, Shankaracharya stopped the system of religion in India. That was his big contribution, was to reestablish the Brahminical system, the Smarta Brahmana system, as it carries on in India today. Even what's left of it was actually established by Sripad Shankaracharya. In a few short, left this world after only 30 years or so. He was quite young. And his really clever thing that he did, of course, was explain the transcendentalist part of the Vedas in a way that could be understood by atheists. The Buddhists are Nastika, and the major Buddhist philosophy is called Shunyavada. It's Nagarjuna, the Madhyamaka Buddha school of this Shunya, void. You must know that the Buddha never said void. He said, "I cannot talk about these things." It's very. If you read Buddha, he's quite clever, actually. What seems to have happened is when he was asked about things like the soul, you could see in the text, it's a little stylized. They would say, "Is there a soul, or is there not a soul? Or is it the case that there both is and is not a soul, or is it not the case that there both is and is not a soul?" There's some kind of logic at that time, and four possibilities. Is there a God? Is there not a God? Or is it the case that there both is and is not a God? Or is it not the case that there both is and is not a God? So this is where they ask these questions, you know. This is the Buddhist scriptures. And so the reply was attributed in these texts to Buddha. He says that the Tathagata, that's a name for Buddha, means he who has come, that the Tathagata has no theories. "I have not come to talk about these things. I have come to teach you that, and then he goes in this whole elaborate description, which basically says that life is suffering, that it's perpetual suffering, that birth is suffering, death is suffering, that old age is suffering, that disease is suffering. And I've come to teach you that the cause of all this suffering are our attachments, our cravings, our desires. And I've come to teach you how that you must extirpate these, uproot, destroy these desires," and so on. "That's all I've come to say." Simple thing. Nothing about philosophy or metaphysics. I've just kept his mouth shut. And what could he say if he didn't accept the authority of the Vedas? What could you say? When he says, "I have no theories," or "I'm free from all theories," he's saying, "I'm not going to speculate." I thought it was pretty good. That's the only thing to do. But from his silence about these topics, then other people developed this philosophy of shunyatva, voidism. But that became the popular, the way that anatma, there's no soul, there's no God, there's no dharma, there's no essences, that kind of philosophy of perpetual flux. So when Shankaracharya wanted to restore the Vedic teachings, he found a way to take actually Nagarjuna's philosophy and rewrite it in Vedic language, like rebaptize it. Nagarjuna says void, a shunya. Shankaracharya argues against this. On the authority of the Vedas, he says no, Brahman. But what is that Brahman? Has no name, no form, no qualities, no relationships. How does it differ from void? It's the same thing. It's cognitively identical, but just a different name. So in this way, these people could make an easy transition from Buddhism to Vedic culture again. I myself and different devotees I've talked to, I started out life intellectual life as an atheist and a believer in empirical philosophy and modern science. And by studying philosophy in the university and starting to understand what are the limits of empirical knowledge, begin to say that there are definite theoretical limits to what you could know, but yet there was something beyond that theoretical limit that was in some ways interesting or compelling or potent, but you couldn't know what it was, whatever it was. It was out there, the ding an sich, the thing in itself, the, you know, wovon man nicht sprechen kann, darüber muss man schweigen, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent, what's out there. Somehow or other the profane void of just nihilism becomes the sacred void, and one goes from being a scientist to a Buddhist. This is happening all over the place. And then from that Buddhism, it's very easy. Same thing happened to me. Then you get interested in Shankaracharya. And somehow or other, it seems to be a superior to just plain old Buddhism. And then actually, if you actually understand Shankaracharya, you become a Vaishnava. Most people don't. But that's also another steps of progression. So Shankaracharya, he stopped the Buddhist system in India. They went outside to Sri Lanka, those places in Southeast Asia, China. Buddhism spread there, but pretty much outside of India, Tibet, in Tibet. So and then Shankara, he revived the Vedic system, but in the same time it was Mayavadi. And then finally Vaishnavacharyas and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu finally effected this Vedic restoration. Somebody asked me the other day, why did Krishna have to do it like this? Isn't there a better way? But you say, well, if I were God, I'd do it differently. I suppose you could think like that. But we see in this world that Krishna sometimes, his ways are like that of a snake, you know, it goes this way. It doesn't go from here to here, but it's always like this, you know, it's never quite straightforward. And it's the reason seems to be that he's dealing with the jivas who have a certain amount of freedom. And you cannot compel them to truth. You can only persuade them, urge them, shove them along, nudge them in a little direction. And so in this way, when he works in the world, it's very difficult. There's an element of relativity in revelation. The Vedas are revealed knowledge. It comes apurusheya. But because the Vedas are directed to many different kinds of people, it speaks in a different way. To this person, one thing is good. To another person, the same thing is bad. Right? Let's go through Prabhupada and find the quotations. Householder life is good on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, householder life is bad. Huh? And you can get your quotations lined up on both sides. And then you can sit there and ignorantly throw them at each other, you know, which has happened in our movement, like this kind of thing, without ever understanding what the whole business is about. In the Middle Ages, there was Abelard. He composed a controversial work called Sic et Non, Yes and No, in which the Bible and authorities on different questions. One group, one set of quotations that said yes, another the same thing said no. And I always thought that we could do an ISKCON, you know, itti netti cha. go through and find yes and no. But somebody has to have some judgment to understand what is the application. There is this element of relativity because these things are supposed to be applied intelligently by people who know what they're doing to different people in different circumstances. And that's the case within the Vedas. There's sufficient amount of relativity. Not that Krishna is not absolute, but he's speaking to people in different conditions. And so it has to be adapted. The teachings there to time to encourage them to make progress in their spiritual life from wherever they are to go forward. And so it will be different for different people. And the same kind of relativity extends outside of Vedic culture in the proper sense to all the different religions in the world. Again, people are speaking who Prabhupada regards as authorities, as sent from Krishna, Jesus, Muhammad, Buddha. There's so many, they say so many different things. And then people say, oh, well, they all say different things, it must be all wrong. But we have to understand intelligently what Krishna is going about. And from these stories in Bhagavatam, we began to get the actual understanding of what is happening, and we're supposed to become intelligent ourselves. Wise, actually. The Sanskrit word is wise. We're supposed to be vijnana. Jnana means knowledge that's contained in the Vedas. Brahmins are supposed to be jnana vijnana astikyam. Jnana means they know what's in the Vedas, and vijnana means they know how to apply it. That's wisdom. And, you know, wisdom sometimes you only get by suffering, by making mistakes and suffering the results and learning that way. But that's our job, is to learn the proper application of these things, understand what the principles are, and learn how to apply it concretely according to time and circumstance. So any questions? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean he's a good husband, though, does it? He's a great husband, but, you know, Daksha couldn't, you know, it's like his daughter married a freak or a hippie or something, you know. Daksha could not appreciate renunciation. That was his the limitation on his vision. You notice later on he also curses Narada Muni. Not just from the Shaivite side of things, but also the Vaishnava. Everybody who's a transcendentalist gets on the bad side of Daksha. Yeah, so he's limited in his vision. He was just really irritated by Lord Shiva. Didn't like it. The pearls of fatherhood. Huh? If you have daughters, you know, it's so dangerous always there. Anything else? Yeah, but look what he had to go through his surrender, you know, with his brain transplant. Yeah, right. Head transplant, the whole thing. Right. No, he didn't. It's interesting, huh? No, it's true. He didn't. He actually kept his own brain. It was just the humiliation of being goat-faced Daksha. Yeah. That's right. Okay. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.